Vamos a pensar.
Keep clapping. My name's Simon, I'm an addict. First I want to say thank you to Narcotics Anonymous for having this opportunity to still be alive and to have this gift of recovery. Thank you. Then I want to thank the Danish Fellowship for welcoming me into its heart on more than one occasion. Not many people welcomed me more than once anywhere. People often didn't welcome me once. So thank you. I want to thank the committee for inviting me to speak. I would like to thank Thomas and Elizabeth for inviting me into their home. And I would like to thank all the people who have smiled at me in the last 2 days. Whether I know you or not, it's been a really good experience to be here. And I'm here to tell you that a smile is really important. Especially at conventions where emotions can run very strong. You know, my experience is that they go up and down and up and down. You know, I've been to many conventions. And it's always like this. I think it's just the nature of us meeting together. I think the energy that is here is so great that this happens. And for those people who have caught my eye and smiled, thank you, because you have helped me to feel okay when I don't feel okay on my own. And this is how this works. You know, somebody once told me to ask me to describe my understanding of a higher power, and what I said was what was said to me, and that is, I am powerless. When I come together with you, I become we. We are not powerless. Therefore, God is here. There's a couple of other things I want to say before I start. The first is that what I say is what I think. This is my version of the program of recovery in Narcotics Anonymous. I like to think, you know, my ambition is that what I say is the same as what NA believes. But that's not necessarily always the case. So please be clear that this is my version of events. Okay? I do not speak for Narcotics Anonymous, I speak about Narcotics Anonymous. I would also like to welcome you, if you are new. You never have to use again. Never. If you are new here, welcome. If this all seems like hysterical bullshit, keep coming back. Because you know what? It is. If you feel mad, you're in the right place. You know? If you don't feel mad, you're probably in the right place. Not many people are going to be sitting in here by accident. This is not the kind of place people come and go, whoa, fuck, what am I doing here? So you're probably here for a reason, and if you don't know what that reason is, stick around. I hope to help you understand that. Okay. Several people have asked me if I get nervous, and I mean the honest answer is no, I don't. And the reason I don't get nervous is first because I've done this before. Second because I'm really good at this. And I don't mean that in an arrogant way. You know, I try to be humble when I say that. You know, I feel grateful that I have a gift, and I feel it is a responsibility to share our gifts. I feel it's a responsibility for me to share what I can do. You know, we all are good at something, and I'm happy that this is what I'm good at, because I tell you what, it's really good up here. This is great. Watching everybody come in, I mean, I get a little anxious sometimes because I have a disease that lives in my head. It lives between my ears, and it says, this time it will be shit. You know, it doesn't matter what happened last time or the time before. This time it's going to be shit. And I have a really good friend in NA who last month celebrated 40 years clean. And he lives in Hawaii. His name's Tom. Some of you will know him. And I went to Hawaii in October to their convention to speak. And just before I went on stage, Tom came over, and I thought he was going to give me a hug. And he just leant towards me and said, Simon, don't fuck it up. So, it's good advice, you know. And what Tommy does, and one of the reasons I love him, is that he sees me. You know, he sees me, and he loves that. And I'm really grateful for that. And that's what I've learned in recovery, and that's what I come for. Is you know, outside of NA, this work we call this, it's called compassion. It's to love the person behind the action. And many, many, you know, spiritual disciplines talk about compassion. We tend to use unconditional love in NA, and they're interchangeable. But I really, you know, I do some spiritual discipline outside of NA, and compassion is a real ambition for me, and it's not very easy to achieve because I have lots and lots of ego, and it separates me from everyone, makes me feel anxious and alone. But here I'm at home. So the topic of this this share is more will be revealed, and I hope it is, because I have no idea what I'm going to say. That was meant to be a joke, so thanks for laughing. I'm in trouble, man. Okay, so what happens? I will tell you some of my story and tell you some of the things I've learned. My earliest memories as a child are, I now understand, are just complete self-obsession, self-absorption. I remember that my father left when I was young. He drank, and he left, and I remember when my mother and father sat me and my brother and sister down and said that he was leaving, and immediately I thought it was my fault. It was because I'd been bad. Because they, you know, everybody always told me I was naughty, and I thought that if I hadn't been bad, he wouldn't have gone. And it took me a very, very long time in recovery to be able to say that out loud, you know, that it wasn't my fault. And to come to accept that one of the reasons I am who I am is because there was no father in my life, you know. It didn't make me an addict. But it made a lot of my nature, my character, my personality. One of the reasons for me it's very difficult to spend time of intimacy with men is for this reason. I learned before I came to NA. I did some studies, and one of the things I learned was that we are all different, but we are different in very similar ways. And I like this very much because it describes us. You know, I look around this room and I identify with the people, you know, sitting at the back. I identify with the people in the back row upstairs and sitting on the side on the floor. And because I remember doing stuff like this, you know, and I identify with the people who come in early and sit at the front. Because there are many characteristics that you have that I have too. There are many more things that are the same here than are different. And I remember that one of my early memories was my mother used to give birthday parties, when it was my birthday. Duh. And we used to invite other kids to come to the house, and she would do. I remember one year she did a treasure hunt, so she would hide things in the garden and we had to go and find them. And I was really angry when other people found things because they were mine. And these are the kinds of things I remember, you know. And I remember at school because I wore glasses from when I was very young. And I remember I was one of the guys who was always picked last at sports. You remember there would be people standing and two captains and they would choose? And the worst thing was to be last. And I was last almost all the time. And these things taught me stuff. It talks in our literature, and I hear people talk in meetings about the sense that they had as a person, you know, the sense that they were different to others, that they were less than or more than, that they always felt separate from. And I remember, these are the things that I remember, you know. I'm certain that, you know, during my childhood and my adolescence, I had times when I was very happy, but I don't remember them. You know, I remember the times when I felt lonely and afraid and isolated and picked on. And I think in a lot of ways that's part of my disease. You know, part of the way that I have remembered my history, I've created my own history, is affirming of my disease. What I've learned in recovery through going to meetings and getting a sponsor and working the steps is I've learned by writing about myself and who I am to question some of that, to question that everything that happened when I was a child was awful, that people always bullied me and tortured me, and that everything was sad, and because I'm not certain that that's true. I can't imagine. I think if that was true, I would be in a psychiatric hospital or dead. You know, I'd be sitting in the corner just banging my head on the wall, you know. I don't think I could have survived that for all those years, you know. My drug career started, I think, probably when I was about 10, when we went as a family to see some relatives, and on Boxing Day, the day after Christmas, we went round and they had drinks. And there was a glass of, I thought it was Ribena, you know, a blackcurrant drink on the table. And it was sweet something, Cinzano or something probably. And I drank it and I remember feeling really warm and everybody was laughing at me. I thought they were laughing with me because I was falling over and laugh. You know, I was drunk and 10, and it's funny. I've heard people describe this since in meetings and conventions. What happened was I identify as I found hope, I found courage and strength, and you know, I lost fear then. I think my using career started then, really. I don't know whether I was born an addict or whether I became an addict. I don't know. I'm sure one day scientists will discover a gene that says this is the addict gene. That doesn't make any difference to me, really. You know, if they find a gene, then I've got it. And if they don't find a gene, then I've probably still got it. And they do what they do. You know, they want to find a way in science to show this, and that's fine. That's what they do. You know, what I have is really well described in our literature. You know, I have an obsession and a compulsion and a self-centeredness. And it manifested itself in my life in using drugs. Lots of people don't take drugs and have this disease. Lots of people take drugs and don't have this disease. That's the truth of it. Not everyone who takes drugs is an addict. And not every addict takes drugs. So what that says to me is that this disease is not about drugs. Duh. It's kind of obvious, really. I was good at maths at school. It's about the only thing I was good at, actually. You know, I heard people say that early in my recovery, and it was, you know, it quickly became clear. You know, the fact is that I use drugs like you use drugs. You know, I use them for courage. I use them to hide behind. They made me, I was someone plus drugs. I found it too difficult just to be Simon because that didn't feel enough. Wherever I was, it just never really felt enough. You know, I went to a boarding school for 8 years where, you know, I lived at the school and it was very tough. You know, it was very strict. We had to march in ranks of four, like in the army, to breakfast and lunch and dinner. And it was really strict school. I was beaten a lot. I was physically, sexually, psychologically tortured by staff and other pupils during that 8 years, and that's not my fault. It's just what happened. But what I learned from that experience was that no one was to be trusted, and that I was very bad at choosing the people to trust. I would choose people who chose me. And if you asked me, would you like to, I would say yes before I knew what it was. Because I wanted to be included, because I felt so isolated. And I got myself into a lot of trouble. You know, I found myself in some really very difficult, painful, fearful situations. And that continued after I left school in my adolescence and my adulthood and my early drug career. It was the same. You know, I found myself with people I didn't want to be with, who I was afraid of, who were generally bad people, who didn't care about me, who had no compassion, and wanted to use me. And I was happy to let them use me because it meant that I wasn't alone. You know, I need to say, and maybe it's obvious, but I look at my past with the benefit of understanding. I can look at it now with knowledge about recovery. I didn't think this then. You know, I thought everything was awful and I was a victim and it was your fault because some really terrible things happened in my life. One day I'll write a book, maybe. You know, I listen to stories from people and some have worse stories than me and some have not so bad stories and I suppose it doesn't really matter because we found our way here. Whatever it was, however bad it felt, you found your way here. And when you arrive here, what is said to you, I hope, what it was said to you is, we don't care who you are. We don't care where you've been, what you've done, what you have, what you don't have, what you look like, how you act, what your sexual orientation is, whether you're smart or stupid, whether you can read or not. We don't care. What we care about is what you want to do about the problem you find you have and how we can help you. It's a very simple thing. So this is my ambition. My ambition is not to care what you have and what you don't have. My ambition is not to care how you look, whether you are smart or not. And if I'm honest, it's not always like that. You know, it's what I want, and it's the ambition I have, and it's my intention. But the reality is that the main reason my life is now difficult is because I find those things hard. I find it hard to be compassionate. I find it hard to love you for who you are and not how you sound and how you look and how you act. You know, and I'm sorry. It's not my fault. I'm sorry. I try to take responsibility for this, and the way that I do that is by working the steps. Because working the steps teaches me who I am, but it also teaches me who you are. And if you want to learn about the steps, sponsor people. I've learned more about the steps from being a sponsor than a sponsee. Yeah. Absolutely no doubt. Because when I'm with a sponsee who is working a step, I have to be on it, or they will know. So I learn much more from being a sponsor. And if you are not yet a sponsor, why not? Why not? In Iran, there are perhaps now 5,500 groups every week. This has gone from 50 to 5,500 in 10 years. It is the fastest growing 12-step program in history. And 70%, about 75% of NA in Iran has less than 3 years clean. Most people sponsor 100 people because there are not enough people with time. So some sponsors sponsor 100 people. And for me, the clear message from this is if you have some experience of working the steps, you can help someone who has no experience of working the steps. You know, you don't need to know everything about every step before you start to sponsor people. I am not of the belief that you must have reached a certain point in recovery before you can help others. You know, if you have 5 days, you can help someone with 4 days. Because that's how it is. I imagine your experience is not different to mine. And when I was days clean, someone who had 30 days was like a god, you know, because they had so much time. I found it really hard to imagine what 30 days without drugs was like, you know. And now, it's, you know, I laugh at that. And when I was in Hawaii, someone gave me a key tag. There is a new key. It's not an official key tag, I need to say. It's someone in Iran made them, actually, but it says multiple decades. It's purple, and it's great. And I now have multiple decades of recovery. And that's, you know, that's great. All you have to do if you want multiple decades of recovery is stay clean for multiple decades. It's not a complicated thing. And I'm sorry if you heard that before. There is this addict, and he is looking in a rubbish bin, a big rubbish bin for some food. And he finds an old pot. And he thinks, maybe this is worth some money, I can sell it. And he rubs it, and there's a big flash of smoke, and a genie pops out of this, comes out of this pot and says, I am the genie of the pot. You have three wishes. What is your first wish? And the addict thinks for a moment and says, I want a bag of heroin that never runs out. There you are. What is your second wish? I want another one of them. And that's funny, but it says something very real about addiction for me. And you know, it doesn't matter how much I had, it was not enough. And that's what is common now. You know, I didn't take drugs now for a long time, but my disease is still there, and this not enough is still there in my life. It's like it's live in my life. And I'm clear, really clear, that this is not about drugs. And I'm sure you hear this in your meetings, that for me, drugs were the solution to the disease of addiction for me. They were like medicine for my disease. But they stopped working, like sex stopped working, and gambling stopped working, and relationships stopped working, and work, actually work never stopped working because I never did it, but it would have stopped working if I had done it. And all of those things stopped working, and what I was left with at the end was me. And what I did was I came here and I said, this is all I've got. And you said, keep coming back. And so I did. Because it's all I wanted, really. And if you had asked me while I was using what I wanted to feel free. I wanted to feel safe, to feel peace, to feel love, to feel connected. That's what I've got. I didn't believe that it was possible. You know, I thought I would die as an addict eventually. A couple of times I tried to kill myself. Not particularly well, obviously. I was pretty shit at killing myself, frankly. But each time, you know, there were plenty of occasions where I remember clearly thinking, I don't care if I live or die. I would be in a car with someone who was drunk or off their face, driving just crazy, and I wouldn't care. I would go. I remember thinking, I don't care. You know, and I had one of my friends, his older brother used to do chemists and used to take the whole cabinet. They made these chemists, a whole chain of chemists, and they have a roof light, a light in the roof, a glass in the roof, and it was large enough to take the whole cabinet through. It's kind of stupid, really, wasn't it? You'd think you'd make the hole in the roof smaller than the cabinet, but hey. So they used to go in there and take the whole cabinet. And we used to get all the drugs that didn't have names, would just have numbers on them. And so we would sit in a circle, me and my friends, and we would take it in turns to take them. And we didn't know what they were. And we would take it in turns. And if that is not caring whether you live or die, I'm not sure what is, really. You know, I've got lots of stories about using, and I'm sure you have too. And the fact is that what it did was it brought me to a place where I needed you more than I needed drugs. And you said come back, so I did. I went along to meeting after meeting after meeting, and I heard people talk about me. You know, because you talk about me when you're, you know, well, I imagine, because you're talking Danish, so I'm guessing you're talking about me. The same kind of stuff. But you know, the reason I go to meetings is because what I hear is the solution. And at its most basic, the solution is just to come back again. You know, it's important to get a sponsor and to work the steps. It's important, I believe, it's important to use the literature that that Narcotics Anonymous provides. I declare that I'm a member of Narcotics Anonymous. I'm a proud member of Narcotics Anonymous. I have one disease. I only need one fellowship. That's not to say, you know, I'm happy that you do what you do. It's not a judgment or a criticism of anybody else's recovery. But for me, the message is clearest if I hear it from one place, from one book, from one program. And because I'm easily confused. So I don't have an allergy. I have a disease. And the solution to my disease are the 12 steps of Narcotics Anonymous, as given to us freely and with love by Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm very grateful to that. But, you know, I'm grateful to my mother for giving birth to me. I don't need to live in her house and eat her food. I've moved out, you know. I have my own house. And as a result of moving out and getting my own house, I can now recognize that she's a person. And she has a right to be who she is, and she had a right to do what she did to me. And I understand and love her for that. And it took leaving home to get that. And I think that that's what we're doing in Narcotics Anonymous now. We're growing up and moving out. We have our own fellowship, literature, culture, understanding of the 12 steps. And we should be proud of that. I have been involved in service in Narcotics Anonymous since really early in my recovery because people told me that's what I should do. And it's one of the five things. Go to meetings, get clean, get a sponsor, work the steps, do service. That's it. You do that, you'll stay. If you miss one, you'll struggle. If you miss more than one, you'll really struggle. The more you miss, the more you'll struggle. It's kind of obvious that. But you just have to do your best. You know, there's no bar over which you have to jump here. You know, it says in the basic text that the hoop you must jump through is as big as you need it to be. You know, it's for you to decide how much you do. I personally believe that people who come to NA and do not do service are stealing. You can like that or not like that. You can like me or not like me. That's your choice. I truly believe that the future of our organization is based around how much we are prepared to put into this. That means all of us. You know, if I could look at every one of you, I would mean every one of you, all of us. There are people out there who haven't got this. They deserve it as much as you. And I would have got clean a lot sooner if someone had told me about NA, I think. And nobody did. So I'd like to get to them before they die. That's kind of my way of seeing this. And my responsibility here today is to tell you what I think. And I would encourage you to take what you want from this and leave the rest. Yeah? So when I arrived in NA, I want to try and focus on the topic. When I arrived here, at my first meetings, it was clear to me that heroin and cocaine were my problem, and maybe alcohol, but it was really, you know, I was a smackhead, right. And I came to NA, I met real smackheads, right? And I was kind of an amateur junkie, really. You know, I lived at home with my family for most of my using, and you know, I had sheets on my bed and money I could steal from my family and things I could steal from my family, and I never really survived out on the street. I don't know if I could, frankly. And I came to meetings and met real hope-to-die dope fiends and felt I needed to kind of qualify. But, you know, I had a big reservation when I came about marijuana, because I thought it was from God and it made everyone peaceful, man. And it would stop wars and make the world a better place. And it took some people to explain to me that I needed to read the literature and be abstinent from all drugs before I kind of worked out that it was a drug. And I needed to be abstinent from that too. And it didn't matter. When it says it doesn't matter what drugs, it means it doesn't matter what drugs. And I would always ignore what it said. You know, when I took exams at school, I always fucked them up because I never read the question. I thought I knew the answer without reading the question, you know. And if there's a trick to this, read the question, you know. Read the literature. It's all there, you know. We've spent approaching 60 years writing this stuff for each other. And it's amazing to me that I still fail to go there when I want to know something. Because it's there, you know, we've written this down. There is not a thing that I will need in my recovery that someone before me hasn't previously needed and found an answer to. Not a thing. And I just need to look for it. That's why I come here, you know. That's why this is first in my life. The first thing I am is an addict. The second thing I am is a football fan. Although, during a game, I'm very confused about the order of these two things, I need to say. When I came into recovery, I really hated football fans. I thought you were stupid. I mean, I'm trying not to look at anyone here, just in case I get into trouble. But because I just thought people who were interested in sports did it because they were thick, because they, you know, I hated it. About 3 years in, maybe 4 years into recovery, I was working. I'm a carpenter for my job, and I was working in a house. And I went in on a Saturday, and I came out at lunchtime, and it was very close to the stadium in London. And those of you who are sports fans will understand this, and if not, then just nod and pretend you do. Okay? It was like the world was standing. You know. The people were standing still and the world was moving. It was the most extraordinary thing. There were thousands of people walking towards this ground. And it's a really moving thing with everyone with a common purpose. It's a bit like everyone coming in here before the meeting. You know, everyone walking into NA. It's an extraordinary feeling of belonging and identity. It's very tribal and all of those things. And I had a moment of clarity, one of those moments that are really precious in recovery, in life maybe, where I understood something at a really fundamental level. And I realized that the reason I hated football is because it was easier to hate it than feel the pain of knowing I had no one to take me when I was 8 years old. And all my friends were taken by their dad. And I didn't have a dad. And I learned to hate it because it hurt too much to want to go and not go. And I realized all of this in a second. And I went. I went and bought a ticket, because in those days we could just walk up and buy a ticket. And I went. And I've been going ever since. The next season I got a season ticket, and I've sat in the same seat for 8 years now. And I go with 10 people in NA. And I was in Moscow last year for the final, where we lost in the last kick of the game. And The first thing that happened after this, it was awful, really, awful. And the first thing that happened was I got a text from a friend of mine in the Ukraine, said, "Simon, remember step three." And I only cry about football. And it was so precious to me, because I know they're not interested in football. And they watched it because of me. And they saw what happened, and they thought of me first. And it was a beautiful moment, because it was hugely important to me, but it was a thing. It doesn't matter. And I hope I remember that feeling for all my life. And it's a feeling, a true feeling of being loved, of being important to someone, and knowing that being important to someone means more than what some lazy bastard who earns £100,000 a week can do with a football on a field, frankly. One of the things I love about football is that when I go, I get to really understand what powerless is. If you want to know what powerless is, sit in the crowd at a football game and hope your team will win. Right? If I had control over them, they would win every game. But it's a great experience, and it's great to be a part of this. And I think that there are many things that are a metaphor for life, you know. And for me, I have found that because I love football, I found it's a very good metaphor. And for example, it's a little like service and the way that we do service in NA. You know, the team that I follow has something like 350 people it employs, you know, who have a job with the club. Everything from cleaning the floor, to working in the shop, to making the tea, to putting the white line on the field, to sweeping the stadium, to playing on the field. Okay? And so there are about 350, and on the field there are 11. And it's best that is the 11 on the field, not the guy who sweeps the stadium or make the chips in the shop. The best people are the ones on the field for that. And the job of everyone else is to support them. And for me, this is a very good picture of the way NA is. You know, we don't all have to do this. Or we don't all have to do the speaking at public information. Or we don't all have to sit on the reception desk. There is a job for everybody here. There is a place for everybody here. And what you will learn if you stay is what you're good at. You know, not everyone is good at this. Some people will say, "I'm not good at this," and they may be right. But we all have skills, you know, and I think what NA has given me is an opportunity to find what I can do, what I'm good at. But more than that, and probably more importantly than that, what NA has given me is a chance to find what I am not. And what I cannot do. Okay. For me, this is really fundamental. And coming to understand my limitations, the things I find difficult, the things I do badly, it's been really important to me. And to try to accept myself. You know, that I'm not, 2 meters 10. I'm not dark and handsome. No. Okay, I know. To learn what I'm not is very important to me, and because it helps me to accept who I am. And I think what has really been revealed to me through working the steps and working with a man and working to develop a trusting, intimate relationship with another man has given me a chance to forgive myself for what I'm not. It's not my fault. There's very little, really, that's my fault. And I think what I love is that I don't really even think so much like that anymore. It's not about fault, blame, problem. My life is filled now with hope, expectation, anticipation, promise, plans. I've really tried hard to create a world where I can achieve things. And I learned a big lesson really early in my recovery when I was working for a woman who was a therapist. I was making some doors in her house. And I've been really lucky in my recovery, and I regularly work for people who are just amazing, amazing people. And we were talking, and she works with children, especially, who have really bad speech problems. I said, it must be very difficult, because, you know, some of these children are really, really struggle to speak. And she says, no, it's easy. And because the skill is to choose something you can achieve and achieve it. And I think this is fundamental. So what I do is I don't set my goals too high. I set my goals so I can achieve them. I set my goal to have a holiday each year. And I have a holiday each year. I don't set my goal to have lots of holidays, or to have a fantastic car, or to have a beautiful girlfriend. And as a result, I actually have all of those things. I'm kind of lucky, really. I keep coming back to the same thing. You know, as I'm speaking, I keep wanting to say the same thing, and that is, you know, it's in the steps. This stuff is in the steps. What I did was I surrendered to this program. I admitted I couldn't do it on my own, and I surrendered to this program. And I accepted that if I came here, I would find sanity. Then I turned my will and my life over to this program, because this program is a power greater than me. Then I wrote a list of what had been done to me, what I was angry about, what I wanted, what I didn't want, who I thought I was, and I told somebody else. Such a big thing. I wrote down my secrets, and I told somebody else. And then I became willing to change. And for me, it's not a big, I don't have to climb a mountain and speak to God to do this. I have to quietly close my eyes and say, I will do your will. You tell me what it is, and I'll do it. And then I wrote down a list of the people I'd caused harm to. And I became as willing as I could be to pay them back the money. It wasn't all money, but a lot of it was. And each time I have worked this eighth and ninth step, it has become more about me and the emotional damage I've done to people. It started off by being about money, because I didn't want to pay them back. The truth is, I didn't want to pay them back. Because I didn't think I could, and over time, I've done the eighth step a few times, and each time it's more about the hurt I caused people, the fear I caused in people. You know, when I was at the end of my using and I was at university, I did what any intelligent addict would do: is I made a relationship with my tutor. So I lived in the house of my tutor, which meant that she would help me write my essay, And then she would mark them. It seemed really sensible to me. I'm not especially smart, but it just seemed really obvious. And so I did really well, although I wasn't really doing any work. And but it was kind of just dishonest. But you know, over the years, I've thought a lot about that woman and how afraid of me she must have been. And I have not found her. I still have not managed to find her. And but my intention is to find her. And when I will tell her I'm sorry. But until I do, I will make amends to people who don't know me. Because I can't make amends to her, but I need to make amends for my behavior. And so one of the ways that I make amends is to give to charity, to give my time and my money to charity. It's never that much money. It feels a lot when I'm doing it, but it's actually not that much, considering how much I have now. You know, I remember at the end of my using, £10 was precious. And if I had £10 and I was hungry, I would stay hungry and spend because I needed £10 to buy drugs. I would prefer to be hungry and buy drugs than eat. And these are not things that are an issue in my life now. You know, I've just finished a food program where I've lost more than 30 kilos because I ate too much. And life is about balance, you know, and it's what I needed to do for myself. I don't, you know, people do what they do, and I felt very unhappy about the way that I felt, that I was, the way I looked, and for me it was a process, you know, coming to find who I was and what I wanted was very much a process. And it took more than 20 years to get to a place where I reached a rock bottom with food, and I realized I was using food like I used drugs. And I don't need to go to a fellowship for that. I go to a fellowship for that. I have one disease. I have the disease of addiction. And it tells me it's never enough. And science tells me if I eat more than I need, my body will store it as fat. Duh. It's not, I'm an animal, you know. I'm an animal, that's what animals do. And, you know, for me it was never genetic. For me it was greed. And greed is a character defect. And I worked a program and I feel really good in myself. I don't put this on anyone else. I tell it purely and simply because it's a part of my story. And each day, I feel really good about myself now. There are always moments in my day when I don't. I have moments of doubt continuously. I have a disease. This is a condition. It's like diabetes. It's a condition. It will not go away, ever. I have it, and knowing I have it is fine, because then I can accept it. You know, it's very important for me to accept the disease I've got, and it comes and goes, this. I think recovery comes and goes, acceptance comes and goes. There are days when I feel great all day, there are weeks when I feel great all week, and there are days when I feel awful, and I hate you. And I don't ever want to go to a meeting again, really. I just find them so boring. Because you say the same things again and again and again. And I know it. I hear myself when I say that, and it just seems so insane. And listen, the reason I don't like meetings at that time is because I forget why I go. I'm not going for me. I'm not going for what I get. I'm going for what I can give. This is about service. Recovery is about service. Being of service. Serving others. And if you're not getting enough out of meetings, you're not putting enough in. Okay, I'm really nearly done. If you heard this story before, I'm sorry, but it's a good story, so it's a bit like listening to a record. Maybe you'll like it again. I used to listen to some record for an hour and a half, over and over and over again, because I really liked it. So it's a little bit like that, okay? Only I don't sing very well. My ambition all my life was to travel. And when I got into recovery, I saved money and I bought a ticket around the world. And I've now been to more than 60 countries. So I'm living my dream. But I was in Southeast Asia, I was in Thailand, and for those of you who have travelled, you'll know this. I always leave on my own. I travel alone, you know, me and God. And because when I'm like that, I look out. Always I'm looking for people to meet and talk to. And I find if I go with some people, I look inwards, and I always speak English, and it's much more difficult to meet people. So I like to travel alone, and you meet people all the time when you're traveling, and so I regularly spend a few days or a week or so with someone, and then we would separate, and you'd meet someone else, and then you'd go for, and then you'd separate. And I was traveling with this Swedish girl by coincidence, right? And she was very cute, and she was really nice, and we were having a great time, and. She had a motorbike accident, not bad, but the bike had fallen and she had burned her leg from the exhaust. It's very common in Southeast Asia because people don't know how to ride bikes so well. The roads are not so good, and it's very common because it's tropical. The burns take a long time to heal, right? So she had to stay in this town with the hospital to have the dressing changed really often so that it would heal. It's very difficult to travel with this kind of injury because it can go septic very quickly. So she had to stay and I had to travel because I was going for a flight. So we made a plan to meet again in Bangkok. And in Bangkok there is a place called Khao San Road. It's a famous road for backpackers, for tourists. And there is one restaurant there. And the wall of the restaurant is maybe like this, big wall. And it is covered with paper, notes from people, leaving messages. And when I saw 9/11, you saw the TV stuff about the Twin Towers and 9/11, the people leaving messages or photographs of their friends, it really reminded me of this place. And it's really beautiful to see hundreds of pieces of paper, some very old, but, you know, people looking for their friends. And it's covered with people's names and... And we made a plan that I would be in this place in a certain week, and if she was there, then you know we would leave a note for each other, and maybe we would meet. And secretly, I hoped she would come more than she hoped I would be there. But it's the nature of my disease. This, I'm really accepting of this. So anyway, I was in Bangkok, and I thought I would look at this wall just in case she had left me a message, and. And there is a note, and it has an NA symbol, a square and a circle, and Simon. And I am really excited. I think it's from her, it's from her, it's from her. And it's not from her. It's from someone called Connor. And what happened was, I wear around my neck an NA symbol. I have since the beginning of my recovery. I'm very proud of this. And it comes off only for x-rays because they tell me I have to take it off. Except for that, I wear it always. And this girl had asked me what it was. And I told her my story. I told her what it was, what it meant. I told her about my, you know, being in NA and my recovery. And she was on a bus in the south of Thailand. And she saw this on a chain around somebody's neck. And she said, I know what that is. And it was Connor, and he was on a relapse. He'd gone to Thailand, was on his own, using. And this stranger had said, I know what that is. And I know this guy who's going to be in Bangkok next Monday for 3 days waiting for me. And he turned around and went to Bangkok, and we met, and we had a meeting, and he's been clean ever since. And what does it say in our literature? It says we must carry this message and practice these principles in all our affairs. And I talked a little about this earlier, but for me this is a very beautiful idea, to carry it, to carry this message. It's like a gift. It doesn't tell me I have to give it. It tells me I have to carry it. If you want it from me, you're welcome to it, but you have to ask me for it. You know, it's your responsibility to ask. It's those addicts out there, it's their responsibility to ask. Because it's their life and their program and their recovery and their disease. But it's our responsibility to carry it. And I carry it for them, right? I carry it for myself first, and I carry it for you, but I carry it for them. Because without them, there would be no we. Because I used to be them, and now I'm we. Now I'm with us, you know, now I'm a part of this. And I like to finish the same way when I speak, and maybe you've heard this before too. And there are now something like 45,000 groups around the world every week. Between 43,000 and 45,000 groups. And some groups meet more than once. In some countries, a group is a venue, a place, and it will meet 6 or 7 times. So there are more than 100,000 meetings, maybe 130,000 meetings around the world. Because of the time difference and the time zones, it is very likely that every second of every minute of every hour of every day, someone is saying the Serenity Prayer, holding two hands or having their arms around two shoulders. It's very cool the way you do that. You all get into rhythm. I don't know if you know that, but you're all doing it in rhythm. I guess you probably do know, don't you? But just imagine that for a moment. Every second of every minute of every hour of every day, someone is saying the Serenity Prayer. And if you are desperate, if you don't think you can do this anymore, if it just feels too hard, and it's too painful, and you feel too alone, try and remember that someone, somewhere, is saying the Serenity Prayer for you. And at the end of this meeting, when we all stand in a circle, and we put our arms around each other, and we say the Serenity Prayer, try to take a moment and say it for them. There will always, always be a place for you in that circle. Always. Whoever you are, whatever you do, wherever you go, however hard it is, there will always be a place for you here. Thank you for listening.
Yes, man.